So welcome, and when we're ready, we have a single case, Ritchie versus, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Donnie. And when you're ready, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Haley Beach, here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Dennis Dane. This court should reverse the district court and grant Mr. Dane qualified immunity for three reasons. First, Bradley and Brodheim do not provide notice that the act of asking an inmate to rewrite an abusive grievance on one occasion is unconstitutional beyond debate.
Now, just on the facts, he asked him to rewrite it, he didn't rewrite it, and then he refused to file it.
Well, Your Honor, he asked that Mr. Ritchie rewrite it. Mr. Ritchie did not do so, and so then it became administratively withdrawn. And actually in a...
Administratively withdrawn means he refused to file it?
The grievance was not processed, correct, Your Honor?
But it was not withdrawn by the prisoner.
It wasn't considered. That's a fact, Your Honor.
Okay.
And in a factually similar case of Clark v. Woodford, this court held that asking or requiring an inmate to remove inappropriate statements from a grievance was not the sort of punishment that Bradley was concerned with and was perfectly constitutional. So the conduct that Mr. Dane engaged in 2011 was something that this court had already approved of in the Clark decision. Additionally, the due process and exhaustion case law repeatedly counsels that prison officials may decide what their grievance systems can receive, and that when they enforce those grievance procedures, they are perfectly entitled to do so without implicating the constitutional rights of the inmates. And so the same conduct that this court and the Supreme Court repeatedly find constitutional and even encouraged for the proper running of the grievance system cannot be somehow considered differently just because the court is reviewing it under the First Amendment context. And my third point would be that the Supreme Court has held that qualified immunity is appropriate where the weight of authority in the circuit cases holds that a right does not exist. And in this instance, the Ninth Circuit is the only court that has held that disrespectful language and grievances is protected, and no court has held that an inmate has a right to include whatever he wants in a grievance without being asked to simply rewrite it. In November of 2012, when the district court judge first considered this case, he dismissed it outright, said that it had not even stated a claim. And the Supreme Court has recognized that it's unfair to deny qualified immunity to lay people and prison officials when even judges disagree about the constitutionality of something. So the fact that it was not readily apparent to the federal judge in 2012 that this conduct was unconstitutional means that it would be really hard to say that some prison official doing his job would have known that, known something that a federal judge did not recognize.
Well, you know, I have a lot of empathy for federal district judges, but I don't think the standard is whether the federal district judge knows. I think the standard is whether it's been clearly established, and I don't think we look to federal district court decisions to establish that.
Correct, Your Honor, but I think it just demonstrates the fact that this was not beyond debate, that in the minds of every reasonable prison official, which is the standard for qualified immunity, that there should have been beyond debate. In fact, in the Zeiler decision, the Supreme Court said that the fact that courts are divided demonstrates that the law is not well established. And so I think the more important point is that there's no precedent on the books in 2011 particularized to the facts of the case that Mr. Dane confronted or the situation that Mr. Dane confronted himself in. The fact that there's disagreement among the circuit courts further demonstrates that this right isn't clearly established. And I think it is telling that even district court judges thought that this hadn't even stated a claim, let alone was something that was clearly established. This case is different from Bradley because, as this court recognized in Clark, asking an inmate, even requiring an inmate, to rewrite a grievance or to remove inappropriate statements is not the sort of punishment or penalty that Bradley was concerned with. And Brodheim, which is the other case that the plaintiff relies, or that the Mr. Ritchie relies on, was concerned with a warning or a threat written on the grievance slip. That's not what happened here. There was no warning. There was simply a one-time direction to rewrite the grievance. So it's distinct from Brodheim as well. And no reasonable prison official would have thought that just asking him to rewrite it would have been akin to making a threat.
Well, but it wasn't just rewriting it. It was after it was rewritten and pretty much continued in the same way. It turns out that the sanction for the disrespectful language is not that you have to rewrite it. It's rather that if you don't rewrite it, we will not process the grievance.
Correct.
So the sanction is not rewriting. The sanction is we won't process it.
Well, there's two choices there, Your Honor. Either you rewrite it to conform to the prison's established grievance procedure, or you are not able to access that established grievance procedure.
Well, I think that's what I just said. Yeah, you and I are in agreement as to what happened.
And the exhaustion case law makes clear that inmates do have a right to grieve, but they have a right to do so in line with the rules that the prison has established.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I think we are in agreement as to what happened. But it seems to me that the Brodheim case is very clear in saying that disrespectful language is not a reason that would allow the prison to refuse to process a grievance. I mean, the Brodheim just says that.
I think that, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that Brodheim says that that disrespectful language is protected under Bradley from penalty or punishment such that you can't retaliate against somebody for it. And what the Brodheim court found to be potentially retaliatory, there was an open question of fact in that decision that they remanded to the district court, was the fact that there was a threat written by the grievance appeal coordinator on that grievance form. And there was also a memorandum which indicated that that grievance coordinator had recommended that that inmate be transferred. And the court said that those two things together could potentially create an adverse action that would chill a reasonable inmate of ordinary firmness.
Counsel, if I could interject a question. Why wouldn't it be retaliatory if they just refused to file the grievance?
Because, Your Honor, in 2011, there was no court decision that had ever found that simply refusing to process a grievance was an adverse action that could support a retaliation claim under Section 1983. In fact, there are many district court decisions that find that this sort of action is not something that is more than a de minimis harm.
Why wouldn't it offend his right to petition?
Because, Your Honor,
in his grievance that they administratively withdrew it.
Because, Your Honor, if the inmate wanted to proceed with that claim, he could merely file his claim in federal court and argue that the grievance procedure wasn't available to him. So it doesn't impede his right to file a lawsuit, which was what Bradley was concerned with, the right to access the courts as part of the right to petition the government. And in fact, in the response brief, Mr. Ritchie basically conceded that he didn't have an actionable claim in the grievance that he was trying to submit. And so for that reason, there's no actual injury or other damage to a non-frivolous legal claim. And for that reason, there's no right to access the courts or right to petition implicated in that scenario.
Okay, thank you.
I would like to reserve the remainder of my time if the court has no other questions.
Fine. We'll hear from the other side, and then you will have some time.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Edward Piper, and I represent Mr. Ritchie, the respondent. I'm going to focus my argument on the second prong of the qualified immunity analysis. Of course, I'm happy to answer any other questions the court may have, but my sense is that that likely is where the rubber is going to meet the road here. And in addition to the points we made in our briefing, I've got three additional points I'd like to add. And I'm going to start where I was planning on ending and address the district court cases that the defendant is relying on. I'd refer the court to page 24 of our answering brief, and specifically to the Terabochia versus Adkins decision, which I think is what frames the mode of analysis through which the court looks at whether authority clearly establishes the rule that's applicable to this case. And that decision says, quote, "We begin our inquiry by looking to binding precedent. If the right is clearly established by decisional authority of the Supreme Court or this circuit, our inquiry should come to an end." Now, as I'll say in a moment, and I think as the court observed, the Brodheim and the Bradley cases are binding precedent insofar as the issues in this case are concerned. And so, because there is binding precedent, the inquiry should come to an end.
Counsel, they're certainly, or at least to me, they seem to be binding on the question whether his right to petition is impacted by the not filing the grievance with offensive language. But why are they binding on the issue of retaliation?
Because they deal with what is essentially the same set of facts. Now, in establishing or in showing clearly established law, we don't need to point to a case that is on all fours, meaning that we don't need to point to a case where a prisoner was punished in the form of being refused access to a grievance system. But I do think Brodheim, relying on a Second Circuit case, did address this question squarely. It said, citing the Second Circuit case, the question for the district court to ask is whether the record taken in light most favorable to the plaintiff reveals statements by the defendant that a reasonable fact finder can interpret as intimating that some form of punishment or adverse regulatory action would follow. Now, I think that the briefing has made very clear and a reasonable...
But that argument elides the notion. It's kind of a logical conundrum. Your argument is that the unconstitutional action of refusing to file is itself the retaliation. Ordinarily, retaliation is I engage in some activity that is protected, and because I've engaged in the activity that's protected, the defendant does something else to me. But here, what is protected is the filing, and the defendant refuses to allow the filing, and you say that's retaliation rather than merely an unconstitutional act.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I agree that in maybe the run of the cases, the retaliation might take some other form. In other words, it might be that the grievance is processed, but because the prison doesn't like the grievance, it puts Mr. Ritchie in solitary confinement or transfers him to a less desirable location.
Does it matter in terms of any remedy that Mr. Ritchie might be entitled to, whether this is a viable cause of action, overcoming any qualified immunity defense with respect to petition, but doesn't get retaliation? That is to say, are there different remedies that flow depending on which of those two rights is at issue, the right to petition or the right to be free of retaliation?
I don't think there are different remedies, Your Honor, and I don't think that's an issue the court...
Well, I'm trying to figure out if it matters.
And I think the answer is no. I don't think it matters for the purposes of this interlocutory appeal. And the reason for that is that, given the facts of this case, I think, as you observed, the questions are sort of one and the same. And let me point out, then, the one sentence. The defendant has suggested that a complex reading of these cases is necessary, and we disagree with that. And I'd like to point out the one sentence based on which I think the court can and should decide both issues. And that's from the Brodheim case. It's page 1271 of that decision, and the sentence is, disrespectful language in a prisoner's grievance is itself protected activity under the First Amendment. Judge Fletcher, I think you said that's what the case says. And that sentence, I think, does dispose of both the retaliation issue and the substantive right to petition issue.
Well, why does that sentence dispose of the retaliation issue?
It disposes of the retaliation issue because, based on the record before the court, there, at minimum, is a tribal issue of fact as to whether that protected activity, Mr. Ritchie's disrespectful language, was the reason that he was refused access to the grievance system as a whole. The rewrites themselves, and this is on pages 168 and 169 of the excerpts of record, say that the grievance is being refused because of its, quote, unnecessary and inappropriate language. And in fact, Mr. Donnie, in his declaration in the summary judgment proceedings, confirmed as much. He used exactly the same word, inappropriate.
Excuse me if I may, counsel. The problem is I don't think you've really addressed Judge Fletcher's concern, which is also my concern. So you have this language which you contend, and I would say there's some support for, is protected under the First Amendment, right? And then you're saying that same act not only constitutes the act, but the retaliation. In other words, there isn't a second act by somebody to retaliate. The very constitutional violation you complain of is not only the constitutional violation, but also the retaliation violation. Am I wrong?
Well, that's my question. It's a bit of a sort of a, it's almost like a logical problem.
I agree, Your Honor. And I think maybe the way to resolve it is to note that in this context, the exercise of the constitutional right takes place over time. The filing of the grievance is an exercise of Mr. Ritchie's right to petition, as well as his participation in the process. And so it's not, say, like an employment case where it would be illogical for an employee to protest the fact that he or she's been terminated.
Well, you're pushing a little bit on our ordinary understanding of the term retaliation. And I think I've heard you say, I'll give you a chance to unsay it if you wish, that it doesn't matter. That is to say, if the defendant violated the right to petition and did so in such a fashion as to forfeit the right to qualified immunity, it doesn't matter whether at the same time he forfeits his right to a claim to defend on qualified immunity grounds from a retaliation claim. So why do we care? I mean, why can't we keep the definition for retaliation within its ordinary easy to understand bounds? Why do we need to stretch it here? Is there any real world consequence that's at issue?
The real world consequence for Mr. Ritchie is his access to not just to participate in the grievance system, but I suppose it would be his right to obtain an adjudication.
Well, he's about to get one, and he may well. But I'm saying, assume for a moment that he wins on his petition for grievances claim, and he wins in the sense that there's no qualified immunity to that because the law is very clearly established. He got his day in court. He wins in court. Why does he need retaliation on top of that?
Well, so this is a critical point, Your Honor. When I say adjudication, I don't mean adjudication in this lawsuit. What I mean is the adjudication of, in perhaps even a non-legal sense, of whether it was right or wrong in the context of the prison.
But I think he's just going to get that, too, by my hypothesis. And my hypothesis is he wins on the petition for grievances claim, and qualified immunity is not sustained as to that claim. So he wins on that.
I'd certainly agree with that, Your Honor.
Well, no, this is hypothetical. If he wins on that, what consequence is there as a practical matter of winning or not winning on the retaliation claim? And I think I've heard you say there is no consequence.
I think that's right, Your Honor, and I think I may have been misunderstanding the question. But as it's framed that way, I think there is no consequence. There are two conceptually distinct claims, but in terms of remedies, in terms of the facts that we're talking about on the ground here, I don't think there is a practical distinction. Does that answer the question?
Well, I think it does, because we do have a sort of a notional understanding of retaliation. I do this, and then you do something else to me because you didn't like what I did, and if my activity is constitutionally protected, the retaliation is unconstitutional.
That's right. And in the particular...
That's the ordinary understanding of retaliation, and you're pushing a little bit on that understanding.
And I think the reason for that, Judge Fletcher, is that this is a unique set of facts in that the grievance process takes place over a period of time. There's an investigation. There's adjudication. And in this set of facts, it's possible for that to happen.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions from the bench? Thank you.
Your Honors, counsel is correct that Brodheim stated that Bradley had held that disrespectful language in a grievance in the Ninth Circuit is protected. However, it's protected from two things, according to Bradley and Brodheim. Under Bradley, it's protected from punishment. Mr. Ritchie was not punished. Under Brodheim, it's protected from retaliation, which in that case was some sort of adverse action. Here, there has been no adverse action.
No, of course there has been an adverse action. It may or may not be retaliation, but the adverse action is, so long as the grievance contains the disrespectful language, he can't process the grievance. That sounds pretty adverse to me.
Well, Your Honor, under qualified immunity, the question is whether it was clearly established that that would have been an adverse action at the time that Mr. Dane acted.
Well, it doesn't take much brains to figure out that if I'm trying to grieve and you won't let me do it, that's adverse.
Well, Your Honor, the prison has a right to have, inmates have no right to a specific grievance process. They have a right to access the established grievance procedure in place at the prison. And so if prisons have a rule that would prevent an inmate from accessing it if they don't follow that rule, that's
but
been...
But what if the rule is unconstitutional?
Here I would suggest, Your Honor, that the rule is not unconstitutional. All that there...
But our case law says that a prisoner is entitled to use disrespectful language in grieving. That's constitutionally protected.
Your Honor, I would argue that Bradley says prisons may not punish an inmate for using that language, but punishment in that context has been distinguished by this court in the Clark decision as not applying to a simple direction to remove inappropriate statements from a grievance. And so Mr. Dane, acting in 2011, had that case as guidance as to the specific situation that he confronted. And the only case to speak to the specific situation that he confronted had said that that conduct was just fine. And the Supreme Court has been very clear that where there's not a particularized case holding that the conduct that an official engages in is unconstitutional, that that person is entitled to qualified immunity.
Let me ask you a different form of question. It's kind of the flip of what I asked your adversary a moment ago. So I don't ask you to concede, if it is unconstitutional for the prison to refuse to file a grievance that contains disrespectful language, and if the law at the time the prison authority acts is sufficiently clear that it's unconstitutional to refuse to file the grievance, that qualified immunity doesn't apply, thus we know that the refusal to file is an unconstitutional act whose unconstitutionality should have been obvious to any reasonable official. So take that as the if. Does it matter what we call it? That is to say, the defendant prison official knew or should have known, because any competent prison official would have known, that his act was unconstitutional. So qualified immunity is designed to protect freedom of action for defendants who cannot know whether their act or cannot reasonably be sure whether their act is unconstitutional. And I've just hypothesized that any competent officer would have known. So why should qualified immunity protect him from a retaliation claim because he acted unconstitutionally and he knew he did?
Because
the only question is what we call it.
Well, Your Honor, in that situation, and that's a big if.
I don't ask you to concede.
The question would be whether in the retaliation conduct the rights were all similarly clearly established, whether each step of that retaliation analysis was clearly established. And here, there was nothing in 2011 telling Mr. Dane that simply refusing to process a grievance was an adverse action that could support a retaliation claim. So on that basis, he would be entitled to qualified immunity. I see him well over time, but I would just like to say that recently in 2017, the Supreme Court held that where courts are divided, a right cannot be clearly established. In this case, there's no Supreme Court precedent on point. There is a consensus in the circuit courts that the right that Mr. Ritchie is trying to redress in this case does not...
But you know as well as we do that the law that governs the people, the actors in the circuit, is circuit law. And if our circuit law is wrong, the Supreme Court will get around sooner or later, usually sooner, to telling us that we're wrong. I think for purposes of qualified immunity, Ninth Circuit law governs.
Even assuming it does, Your Honor, I would argue that Bradley and Brodheim are not precedential on the point in a particularized manner that would have put Mr. Dane on notice that what he did was unconstitutional beyond debate. And for that reason, we would respectfully request that the court...
I realize you're over time, and I apologize for detaining you away one moment longer. I want to ask you the same question I asked the other side. Assuming we hold that there's no qualified immunity with respect to the petition for grievances claim, is there any practical consequence for holding or not holding the same with respect to retaliation claim? I mean, are there any different remedies or anything different depending on whether we call it petition for grievances claim or retaliation claim?
I think practically speaking, Your Honor, I mean, finding two constitutional violations is different than finding one constitutional violation. However, as you know, we would state that Mr. Dane is entitled to qualified immunity from both causes of action. Thank you.
Okay. Thank both sides. Now, as I recollect, you're doing this pro bono?
That's right, Your Honor.
I would like to thank you on behalf of the court for doing this pro bono work. We find it very useful. This is not a preview of the merits. And we'll thank you, too, although you're being paid. Thank both sides for very useful arguments. The case of Ritchie versus Dean now submitted for
decision. May I add that I think both counsel did a superb job this morning of answering very difficult questions, and I was certainly happy that we had argument because you both did a great job, I think.
So thank you very much, and we're now in adjournment. Case submitted.